just now. We've all been involved as a collective family of God, involved in blessing Kit and Romilly this morning, welcoming them and Holly and Jamie, assuring them of our love and support, but also, and more importantly, that of God. It's not that God would not support them if they had not decided to come and ask for Kit and Romilly to be blessed here, but it's a public act which shows that it is something which Jamie and Holly want to say about their lives and their intentions. Also, through this public act by us, the congregation in person and online, by phone and by catch-up, the congregation of this Church of Christ of Palmerston Place, that we recognise Kit and Romilly have a value to God that is more than that of that we might otherwise, that grandparents, that even Jamie and Holly have. They have a value to God way beyond that. Not even a mother's love, to use a well-worn phrase, which no doubt Lisa will tell me off for using as being too gendered or exclusive for those who didn't have great relationships with their mums, but not even that of a stereotypical mum, that unconditional, protective and supporting love. Not even that comes close to the love which God has for Kit and Romilly and for every other child in the world, including you and me, whatever our ages. To quote John Farnham, we're all someone's daughter. We're all someone's son. We are all open, potential recipients of the blessings of God. Now, I've preached a few times recently on different interpretations we can have and we should be able to put on the ideas of the kingdom of heaven or the treasure of heaven or concepts related to that, things which are frequently mentioned by Jesus in the books about him in the Bible. It's that which the young man is seeking. He's seeking to get access to that kingdom of heaven and asking Jesus what he needed to do. One interpretation I spoke about for the kingdom was one which looked at the end of time, and I covered that when I spoke on the parable of the net. Another time, when speaking about the kingdom, I looked at what we should be doing now to make these times more like the heaven that we aspire to reach one day. And at that time, I was speaking on the parables of the treasure in the field and the great pearl. To very briefly summarize, I said that the ultimate kingdom of heaven at the end of time, whilst open to all now, will not have everyone in it. There is a sorting and there is a judgment to come. And I'd refer you to my sermon of the 23rd of July about not everyone having a booked seat on a train for a fuller explanation. On the 30th of July, I spoke about the treasure and the pearl. And I also spoke about the spoonmaker's diamond, the huge 17.5-gram diamond that I saw in Istanbul, which, according to legend, had once been swapped by a fisherman for 5 spoons because he didn't know the true cost of what he held. And how we so often don't appreciate the cost of what we potentially hold through the kingdom of heaven. We don't appreciate what the death and resurrection of Jesus, his taking the punishment for which we deserve for deviating from God's will for this world, so that in time we can be saved, that we won't be punished, but we can be rescued from that punishment and go on to be with God for eternity. Now, both of these are very difficult for us. It's difficult for us to rationalize why, to us, a loving God would just not save everyone, regardless of what they'd done in their lives at the end of time, or at least when they tried to be good in their understanding of good. It's difficult to rationalize that the free gift of Jesus' dying in our place means that we couldn't just or we shouldn't just go on as we please. After all, we are forgiven. But although freely given, that gift of forgiveness does require a cost of us. Not a cost that we should be giving begrudgingly, but rather one that we should be giving joyfully and freely. So how do we do that? How we do that is what Jesus tells us in our reading from Matthew's book about the life of Jesus, which Jennifer read for us earlier. We don't do it by wrestling with great theological issues or moral quandaries. We don't even deal with it in a rational, reasoned enlightenment analysis of the evidence. No, what we should do is we should do it like a child. We just do it in simple faith, because we're told that. The simple faith of a small child that believes what they are told, for example, by their parents or grandparents or the primary one class teacher, without continually cross-examining what is said or asking why. Just accept that you are loved as you are, and you can be saved from the consequences of your actions, inactions, your thoughts, words, and deeds by God, just because he says you can be. But, and there's always a but as I said on the 30th of July, there is a cost. There's a cost of commitment, a cost of a willingness to be changed. Now, meeting that cost isn't a requirement of accepting the gift of being freely forgiven. But why would you not want to at least try to meet that cost if you understood the value of being forgiven? Because you are totally forgiven. You're not like David Hunter, the man recently freed in Cyprus after being convicted of manslaughter for the mercy killing of his tragically ill wife. He's now potentially facing a murder conviction and life sentence for that same killing. He thought he'd served out his time for the crime, but the Cypriot Attorney General is not finished with him yet, and he may yet have to go back to jail. Christ's meeting our punishment isn't like David Hunter's manslaughter conviction, a crime paid for, but one that still faces possible further punishment. Jesus' gift is an absolute, once and for all, complete in and of itself gift of forgiveness. That's a slight digression, perhaps. Let's get back to the idea of cost. Because there is a cost. It's not a compulsory one. It's not a conditional one. It's just one that we should make, not out of a sense of obligation, or because it's required to keep hold of the gift we have of being rescued. But because we are rescued, we should want to make a change to how we live our lives. That's where the second part of this morning's reading comes in. The one dealing with the camel, the eye of the needle. You might have previously heard the tale of a gate in Jerusalem, which was supposedly known as the eye of the needle. And that gate was supposedly so narrow that a camel, the standard beast of burden for many Arabic tradesmen, could only enter that gate if it was unladen. And we all take comfort from the idea that giving up everything at some point to the poor will save us. It's a nice tale, a nice story. It gives us hope that we think we can control ourselves. But there's absolutely no evidence that there ever was such a gate called the Eye of the Needle. However, using this idea of the eye of the needle, Jesus isn't the only person recorded as using that phrase, the eye of the needle. It seems to have been a common enough idiom, and we have several surviving examples in Jewish writing dating from shortly after the time of Jesus. Now, for an idiom to make it into written language, it has to have been used for some time beforehand, and it needs to be well understood, because in writing, there's no way of showing tone of voice or the reader appreciating a knowing wink or a smile as you're talking, as with an email today. You have to read what is written at face value. An idiom only works if everyone knows it. Now, the idiom of the camel in the eye of the needle, it wasn't always a camel. Sometimes it referred to an elephant. Once it's even used in reference to an army not being able to fit through the eye of the needle. But the take-home in every case where that idiom is used is that the thing being talked about, the camel, the elephant, the army, there is absolutely no way they will ever fit through the eye of a needle. So what then did everyone know that the phrase "it's easier to go through the eye of a needle" mean? Simple. It means that it's impossible. Or rather, it's used to describe thinking of things which are not possible. So what Jesus says is that it's not possible to think of a rich man or woman entering heaven. As I said the last time I preached here, our religion has a personal cost to us. Not that the cost is a condition of the religion, but rather, how can you truly have claimed to accept that Jesus, the Son of God, died in our place to take the punishments due to us, if that doesn't have some impact and change our lives? Now, the last time I spoke about repentance, the need to acknowledge what we do, or what we do when it's against the will of God that God has for our lives. That's something we need to do. We need to say sorry. We need to acknowledge when we get things wrong. But this time, I want to focus on ideas of time and finance. Now, they're perhaps slightly grubby, worldly topics. But as many of you know, I'm heavily involved in Castle Community Bank Credit Union down in Leith. I practically care about those with less in quite a proactive way, albeit it's a far from perfect way. We're aiming, through the credit union, to try and increase the general wealth in society in whatever ways we can. But just increasing the wealth in society overall is not good enough. It's a giving that costs us which is demanded of the rich man. And in the UK, we are all rich from a global perspective. We may not have a superabundance, but we may have. We may have a superabundance of cash. We may have a superabundance of time. We may have a superabundance of a willingness to pray. Give time to help. Give time to pray. Give, to be blunt, money to finance God's mission in Edinburgh, Scotland, and worldwide. Regularly, if you feel that is what God is asking of you. But don't just give from your excess. That's cheap rescuing, cheap salvation, a cheap death for Jesus. Show your faith to God by giving something that actually costs you. Just between you and God, although possibly involving the church treasurer sometimes as well, if it is financial, or maybe Paul in the office if you're wanting to join the reading rota, or lead us in prayers for others sometimes. Anyway, the cost that you incur shouldn't have to involve me or Lisa or John or Ian or an elder. It should be a cost incurred as a dedication to the will of God. A cost incurred between you and God, not a cost incurred to show to the world your piety or your largesse and generosity to the people here in Palmerston Place in person and online. Now, we always need people to help out, and so many of you do, and do so much, and go above and beyond all the time. But we always have need for more, and the more we have helping us, the easier it is to spread the burden. More people on the IT desk helping out, more people during the week might help us, enable us to put on more activities. Activities to help our communities, but also activities to help us spread the good news that's at the center of our faith, the good news that we need to share with everyone. And we need money for doing these things too. Doing more is great if we're led to do that, if we have that nag in our soul or that prick of conscience. But it will all come at a cost, a real cost. However, it is a cost that we should be willing to make, a cost that we should acknowledge. But a cost that when we take that cost, when we incur that cost, it should be a cost that we're willing freely to give. It should never be something that's given out of a sense of bitterness. It should never be something that we feel we have to do this. It should always be a cost that we incur because we want to. Like the simple faith of the child that Jesus said was an example of what was needed to be a Christian. A willingness to accept salvation without knowing the full picture. without knowing the end results and all the twists and turns. If we have that faith, we should be able to incur that cost. A willingness to commit to prayer, to commit our time, to commit our money in the faith that God will use it. Because he will, if it's offered, and he will use it wisely. We don't give into a vacuum. We give our prayers, our time, our money, or whatever else it is, to our God, knowing already that we're already completely, unconditionally loved by him. We're held tenderly by him, and we're supported by him in a more real way than by anyone or anything else. We're going to sing in a moment, "I, the Lord of Sea and Sky." And as we sing, I'd like you to think about what I've just said. Think as you sing, as you say these words. Is God calling me to offer something more than I currently am offering? Am I willing to listen to God? And like the voice in the hymn, say, "Here I am. I'll follow what you're wanting from me and from my life." It's following God, not striking out alone, always being with the God who loves us perfectly, not for what we might be, not for what we might do, but we are loved right now, as you are, as you're hearing this word, the whole you, the public you and the private you, the you that you don't even admit to yourself, that you is loved exactly as you are. And in response to that, ask yourself, am I willing to offer more? Am I ready to acknowledge I should always be offering more? Are you willing to make that child's promise, that unconditional offering of saying, "Here I am, use me"? Are you willing to commit something new to God? Consider this now as we stand and sing together our hymn, "I, the Lord of Sea and Sky."